everybody's obsessed about the innovations in the context of the internet. Let's think a little bit about who the innovators were. Right? So the original internet itself, produced by some kids. I mean, obviously, Bob Kahn wasn't quite a kid, but Vint Cerf was a kid, graduate student, sort of sitting down, putting together the protocols that would form the internet. Let's call these kids. Okay? World Wide Web, produced by a researcher at CERN Lab in Switzerland. ICQ, first peer-to-peer instant chat system, was produced by an Israeli kid. He and his father then turned it into a company, which they sold to AOL for $400 million. Hotmail, HTML mail, is developed by an Indian immigrant in the United States, sold it to Microsoft for $400 million. That seems to be the magic number here. Napster, produced by two Boston University undergraduates in their dorm room, right? Think about these innovations and these innovators. What is the common thread? It is that all of these innovators are kids and non-Americans. What? No, he's a kid, though. You're right, it should be disjunctive. Kids or non-Americans, right, right. I knew, you talk to a computer science group, you're just going to hit by this sort of stuff. kids are non-Americans, right? Outsiders. Outsiders to the owners of the most powerful infrastructure or software or content on the net. Now, this is not an accident. It's not just like a happy story that I can tell after going through history. It's totally predictable. Why? Because of the architecture of this network, because of the way this network was designed. Right? Now, this is an architectural principle which Jerry Saltzer, David Clark, and David Reed described as the end-to-end principle of the internet, right? And the end-to-end principle comes from understanding first the layered structure of the network, which I'm not going to adopt the OSI structure. I'm going to just think about a four-layered network where we can think about the physical layer, the machines, the internet layer, the protocol that facilitates the network, the transport layer, the protocol that facilitates data getting down to the network, and the application layer, the stuff that runs on this network. These protocols, these layers operate together to create what we think of as the internet, so that the green layers at the bottom are facilitating the communications between these applications. It is an end-to-end network when these layers function in a particular way, where they place functionality in a lower layer only if that's the only way to implement that functionality. That's the narrow conception of the end-to-end principle, first articulated in 1981. The broader conception of the end-to-end principle says we try not to place functionality lower in the stack where we can achieve it higher in the stack. Right? That's not a necessity because you could achieve it lower in the stack, but it's a bias. It's a bias in favor of putting intelligence at the edge or higher in the stack. So we want a simple network and smart applications that run this network. Now, the consequence of this design, which was selected solely because it allowed innovation without coordination among the network owners, the consequence of this design is to produce something like a neutral network, a network that cannot know and therefore cannot discriminate among applications that are placed on this network. So long as the applications going through the transport layer obey the standard protocols that the internet and physical layer need to facilitate communication, it will run on this network. And you need no permission of the network owner. So this architecture guarantees that outsiders always have the right to innovate in this particular space. They have the right to innovate equally. Innovate equally here means that they have a right to innovate in something held in common. The right to innovate is held in common, and it's that we should think of as the innovation common. Innovation common here is the right people hold equally in the context of an end-to-end network to build applications and services for that network. That right is guaranteed by an architectural design, and it inspires, because of its egalitarian character, an extraordinary range of innovation which otherwise would not occur. Now, why is that? Well, we can see why it wouldn't occur if we consider some of the threats that are now occurring with respect to the end-to-end network. There is a increased desire by network owners, people who physically own the physical layer of the network, cable companies or DSL companies, to change this principle of neutrality. To layer on top of this network technologies that enable them to pick and choose which applications get to run on this network or which content gets to run on this network. Right? These technologies get layered on top of the two layers that I described and have the effect of inverting the end-to-end character, because what it does is relocate into the center of the network the right to decide which innovations will be allowed on this network. They get to pick applications they like and block applications they don't like. So, for example, you're familiar with this device, a television set. You know that for many years we've had videos streamed across cable lines to our television sets. When broadband was just beginning to take off in the United States, people thought, well, could we stream video to computers? Wouldn't that be great? Rather than having just 100 channels, I could have 10 billion channels, mainly the number of computers on the network, and I could begin to pick content wherever I wanted to pick it from. I could therefore have extraordinary competition in video streaming. Now, at the time this issue was being debated, in 1998, Excite was by that time controlled by AT&T. The head of internet services at the time at AT&T was a guy named Daniel Summers, and he was asked, would they be permitting users of their broadband network to stream video or to offer streamed video across their cable network to their customers? Right? Now, you can see the obvious dilemma. If they allow that, it's going to be harder to charge high prices for cable. Right? If you're charging $40 a month to get access to HBO or whatever you're paying for, if I can get content through my internet connection, I don't have to pay for the cable, and I can get lots of great video content through the internet connection. So the choice here is, should they open up competition against themselves by allowing people to stream video across the network? And Daniel Summers responded to this question, not in the most intelligent way, but in the most honest way, when he said, we, AT&T, didn't spend $60 billion, the cost that they paid to buy their cable network, to, quote, have the blood sucked out of our veins. The answer was no. They were not going to permit this type of streaming. They would impose technical limits enforced in part through policy-based routing that would assure that their network would not cannibalize their cable services. Now, this, of course, is to invert the principle of end-to-end. The network owners are in the position of controlling how innovation on this network develops. And many people consider the inability to develop this part of the network broadly as one of the reasons that broadband growth fizzled in the United States, right? We have not talked about this much in this presidential election, but if you think of our standing in the world with broadband penetration, we went from number one just before the end of the last administration to now less than number 20 in the world in broadband penetration, right? And this is because of many factors, of course, some the geographical factors, but in part it's because of IP factors, I think, and the ability to control how these technologies develop. Korea wildly outpaces Japan in broadband penetration. If you ask a Japanese official why this is, I talked to the copyright office in Japan about this, why is Korea so good? They said that's because Korea has an immature copyright regime. And I said, well, what does that mean? And they said, well, they allow the streaming of television across broadband in Korea. Terrible, right? So those immature guys have allowed streaming of television, and that's therefore driven the demand for broadband, because, you know, if you can get television on your computer as well as whatever else, then that increases the value of your connection on the internet. But he said, you know, here in Japan, we're not that immature. We have a mature copyright regime like you in the United States. Now, of course, the mature copyright regimes, as Colin Powell's son, who's the head of the FCC, Michael Powell, has said, chill the development of broadband, because what they do is restrict the opportunity of this network to be used broadly, especially as business owners try to block innovations which threaten them. So this innovation, in some sense, is stopped because the network owners assert this general property right, this general right to control what goes on their property, right? It's their wire, they say, Because it's my wire, I'm allowed to control what you do with it, even if that means inverting the fundamental principle that the internet was designed to. So this right to innovate, if this right to control their property is recognized, will no longer be held in common by all those who connect to this network. It instead will be centralized in the owned owner of the network. This is no comedy anymore, in my view, since I think end-to-end is one of the most important principles that explains the explosion of the internet. This comedy is itself a tragedy. It's a different tragedy of the commons. It's a tragedy of the commons where we don't recognize the dynamic of a non-rivalrous commons and we treat it as if it's cattle.